Your conference is being recorded.
Well, good afternoon. This is Rosemary Heaser with BOK Financial Advisor Trust Services, and welcome to our trust education program. We've created this program to support the RIA community in the area of trust as we develop relationships with our advisor-friendly solutions and trust. Next month, please join us on April 27th for another estate planning topic specifically for advisors. It's estate planning with digital assets, what happens when you're logged off for the final time, presented by Alice Hasseltine of Kirkland Woods & Martinson. As you're aware, each program has a professional presenter, estate planning attorney, discussing aspects of trust and estate planning specifically geared towards the advisor community. And, of course, if you have any suggestions on future speakers, specific content, or any other areas or general comments to help improve our program, we'd love to hear them. We're pleased to have several of our markets participating in today's presentation, and as a housekeeping issue, this call will be recorded for future use, so most of the lines are muted to ensure minimize the background noise. If you have any questions or something specific that comes up that's more state-specific in nature, please feel free to reach out to the presenter afterwards through his contact information or the trust manager in your host location, and they can answer your specific questions. This, as well as future programs, is approved for 1.5 hours of CFP continuing education credits in the area of estate planning, so please make sure you complete the sign-in sheet and include your CFP number. We'll submit your participation in this program online so you'll get credit for the attendance. Today, our presenter is a friend of the company and leader in the probate practice in the Dallas area, and our topic is on estate planning litigation pointers, a litigator's perspective. If you do have any questions, please feel free to contact Kevin Spencer after the session today through either a phone call or his email, which has been provided to you. So let me tell you a little bit more about Kevin. Kevin Spencer graduated from Christian Preparatory School in 85 and earned a bachelor's in business and a BA in psychology from Austin College in 89. Kevin then left Texas to study law at University of South Dakota School of Law and received his JD in 92. Kevin has a thriving litigation and appeals practice with Spencer & Johnson in the Dallas, Texas area, primarily in the area of litigation and appeals, focusing in on all areas of estate, trust, heirship, guardianship, fiduciary litigation, estate administration, including ancillary probate jurisdiction litigation, common law spouse disputes, paternity inheritance disputes, civil appeal, and general civil litigation. That's a mouthful of a lot of areas that Kevin covers, obviously. Kevin has experience in all areas of litigation and has himself tried cases before judges, jury to verdict, and has argued in appellate courts. Kevin appears in court almost every week, from proving up wills or guardianships to arguing more complex and contested matters in advancement of clients' cases. Kevin enjoys the trial process and has tried numerous jury trials and verdicts with success. So we're very pleased to have Kevin involved today in providing his focus on the litigator's perspective and areas of estate planning, and I think you'll find this very interesting today. We appreciate his support, and now we'll go ahead and turn the program over to Kevin. So, Kevin, we'll let you go from here. Our attendees do have your outline material as well as your presentation, and I know there are videos at the end that they'll be watching once the session has ended today. So I'll go ahead and turn it over to you, Kevin. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Rosemary. Appreciate it very much, and appreciate all of you RSVPing and attending this. And I've given this speech to a couple of smaller bars, and I've gotten some good feedback. They found it to be interesting. I'll preface everything by saying that, as Rosemary mentioned, I'm primarily an estate and trust litigator, so we do just about anything that would involve the courtroom related to estates and trust, and we don't do very much estate planning, usually just small estate planning matters for friends and that sort of thing. And the reason is because I don't think that it's right for me to, on the one hand in my occupation and practice, to attack estate planners and then turn around and be an estate planner myself. I think there's a bit of a divergence there, and so we try and avoid it, other than for small things. So I say that to make the point that this presentation is a view of estate planning type work, particularly in Texas, but I think it applies everywhere, you know, relating to or a view from how the a litigator would see the work of an estate planner, and to give tips and points regarding the best way or best practices, I should say, in a planning scenario to avoid the types of things that we see all the time that lead to not only litigation but oftentimes estate plans being set aside for various reasons. So the focus here is on real-life experience and real-life activities that we've seen that we utilize in our practice to try and set aside wills so that in the estate planning practice these things can be avoided and the testamentary plan of the or estate plan of the client can prevail and usually get past the scrutiny that we put on these plans. And so to begin, I think the first point to make is to examine the process of the estate plan. In any good business, you have to look to the people, the process, and the product. And this particular speech involves the process more than anything. Obviously, the estate planner is the people or the person that's involved with that part of the business. The product and how good it is usually dictated by the process and processes that are put in place in order to get to that end product and to make it the best that it can be. And so the strength of the process of the estate planner, of your process, is going to dictate how good your product is. And I'll refer to the slides. There's a little page number at the end, at the far lower right-hand corner that I'll refer to get to the slides that correspond with the slide numbers. And so in looking at slide one, the strength of your process dictates how good your product is. And so what is process? Process is a series of procedures, standardized procedures, that an estate planner puts in place in order to ensure that habits are established and that procedures are instituted to avoid or to make sure that the end result, the execution of the will itself and the execution of the will is done correctly. All states have different rules for what makes a valid will, and so most of this focus is going to be on what works in Texas. But again, I think it works, the general theme of this presentation works in every state. And so when an estate planner puts in place rules and procedures with the people that he or she works with, and then in his or her actual practice, it ensures that the requirements of getting a will executed correctly are satisfied. And so obviously every client is different, every situation is different, all clients are in a different position, both mentally, physically, and in their families. And so each client, even though it becomes a little bit routine, each client needs to be examined, and the estate planner needs to make sure that whatever the client is doing and whatever the client wants is specific to and to that particular client. The standardized procedures you want to do in every case, and those are universal, but they also have to be run through the filter of what does this particular client want. The reason for that is to ensure the correctness of the requirements, the technical requirements of each state, to make sure that the will is valid. When procedures such as that are deviated from, or if someone goes outside of those procedures, the ones that are standardized to meet the requirement of the law, usually that gives a state litigators like myself room to make arguments against the process that was done. And so initially, one of the first pieces of advice that I'll give is, flipping to slide number four, is to keep notes. One of the most crucial and important things that you need as an estate planner or scrivener of an estate plan is to be able to support your work product. And the number one thing that you can do as a procedure and institute in your process is to take very good notes. And the reason for that is I tell my associates all the time, a year from now we're not going to remember that phone call, or a year from now we're not going to remember that meeting, or who was there, or what was said, and the details of it. And the only way to, with all the clients that we have and all the work that we do, the only way to keep up with it all is to have notes that you can refer to, that you keep in the normal course of your business. And when, maybe not when, but if an estate plan is ever attacked or is ever scrutinized, then you have something in your file that you can look to refresh your memory, or in some cases just to provide memory of what actually happened at the time. Oftentimes it does refresh your memory once you can read notes that you've made. And so very important to take notes. The notes can be as minimal, whatever it would require of a particular estate planner to refresh their memory, but oftentimes I look at it like sort of like writing a book about that client, and not a full book, but an outline of what you would put in a book so that you can remember that client as opposed to other ones. But the main thing, once you have notes and once that becomes a habit, is you got to keep your notes. I can't emphasize enough that if you're making notes and that's part of your procedure and that's part of your habit, you've made that part of your process, it's imperative that you keep your notes. What good is it to take notes if you don't have them later to refer to? But more importantly, if you did take notes, then not having them is even worse than not taking notes. If your habit is to not take notes at all, that would be better than to take notes and have them in your file, or have them at least somewhere in your office, and then to destroy them later or to lose them, it's worse. And the reason it's worse is because, first of all, it could create a spoliation claim, or it could create it certainly would create an inference instruction to a jury that there's something in those notes that scrivener or that person that was involved in the process did not want you to see. And that's not anything that any estate planner wants to have presented to a jury, or worse, to have a judge instruct from the bench that they're to infer that there was something in those notes that the other side, the proponent or the scrivener of the estate plan, did not want you to see. So that's how it becomes worse for you to, worse than not taking notes. You take notes and then you don't keep them. There's obviously something that can be inferred from that as being sinister, and there's a reason that they don't exist. Some people we run into say, well, after a certain amount of time, it's just our practice to destroy our files or to destroy our notes. Well, that excuse doesn't work anymore. It used to work 20 years ago, but nowadays with all the scanning possibilities and cloud storage and all the ways that things can be kept, you can destroy your paper file and still preserve the documents themselves. So that's a bad excuse. It used to be an okay excuse, but we could still get the inference that we needed. But nowadays it doesn't work because of the ability to store things in the cloud. You have to be careful because sometimes, I mean, when there are good notes, let me just say this, when there are good notes, it makes it much more difficult for a will contest attorney to challenge what happened that day. The day of the execution, if the notes were taken and made at or around the time of the execution, then regardless of the fact that the person making the notes cannot remember the actual day, then it's much more difficult to challenge what happened, particularly the solemnities and formalities, the procedure that was followed in the execution. But, and really the only argument that can be made is if there's a situation where the notes are so lengthy and so extensive, an argument could be made that, gosh, you must have been worried about something or you wouldn't have made such long and extensive notes. But that's a pretty weak argument. An example of that is on slide 5. We had a memo that was 4 pages long, single-spaced, by the scrivener attorney in a case. And the notes are so good and so detailed that it really made it difficult to challenge the formalities and to challenge his testimony relating to what happened that day and whether the testator had capacity. All we could really say is, you must have been worried to write this many notes. Well, you'd much rather have this many notes. You'd much rather have something that refreshes your memory more extensive detail than to have zero notes. This particular attorney would not have been able to testify as to any of this information 7 years later if he hadn't had these notes. And because he had them, he became a very good witness. We ended up winning this case anyway, but this particular witness was probably their best witness. Turning the page to slide 6, here's an example. I'm going to show you an example of where no notes were taken and there was no way for the scrivener to prove or to show or testify that what he did in creating the will was proper, it was a good process, and that things were done correctly. In this particular situation, we had a gentleman who inherited a bunch of land and oil and gas rights from his father in Auburn, East Texas. And we had a small town country lawyer that was a friend of his that just wrote a will. We alleged that it was written or directed by his wife, and this was the product on page 7. He was a very wealthy man, most of it inherited, but it was accumulated during his lifetime. Most of it his separate property in Texas. It would have been his separate property, not marital property. And this was the will that came out of it. Appears to be a 3-page will, but really the substantive part of it is about a page long. And this guy had a taxable estate. He hated paying taxes. He was almost one of those radical Republic of Texas type people. Wasn't quite in that group, but he was near there from the standpoint of hating the government and not wanting to pay taxes. And there's not a lick of tax planning in this will whatsoever, other than the marital deduction. You'll see at Article 2, he leaves his entire estate to his wife. There's no alternate beneficiary, and it's just really a poor, flipping to slide 8, it's really just a poor result. The scrivener, we argued, and I think validly argued, the scrivener was unable to testify that he knew anything about the decedent's property, unable to testify that they ever talked about any tax issues or what the scrivener, testator wanted, and he had no notes that would have helped him come up with his testimony in that regard, and so this created a really poor result in this particular estate. The testator had 10 kids, so he was married when he died and had 10 kids, and there could have been all kinds of tax planning in that estate relating to annual exclusion gifts and trusts that could have been created for each of the children, certainly could have created a bypass trust and a credit shelter trust so that his exclusion could be preserved and then the marital deduction taken advantage of. No GST, generation skipping tax planning whatsoever. His family was so large that certainly could have been done as well. This particular scrivener of the will, the attorney, would have referred this out to get into that kind of complex tax planning. He died back prior to 2010. So at that time, this estate was taxable and had a large, would have had a large tax bill if it hadn't been left to his wife. But in the years that followed his death, the 5 years that followed, his wife received over $10 million in oil and gas royalty income. And so while that's great and it transferred to her estate tax-free or transfer tax-free, she paid ordinary income tax on all of those oil and gas royalties, and none of that was put aside for any of the children or the grandchildren. The trust obviously would have paid income tax as well, but the growth of the value could have been preserved in other trusts if they had actually done some trust planning. This Scrivener attorney just threw that three-page will down on a piece of paper, and he signed it, and everything was over. But the other curious thing about his will is on page 9, he included Article 4 in that, and basically it says that the testator expects that his wife, who's getting all of the property of the family, all the family assets, shall consult with his oldest son in relation to how it should be invested and how it should be administered. Well, we have no idea why that provision was put into that will, but we as litigators were able to capitalize on that, and we had an alternative theory of relief. If you flip to slide 10, under, in Texas, the Pachelner v. Adler case, which provides that if there's an agreement between the testator and the devisee in regarding how the property should be administered, and in this case, we argued, I'm giving you all of my estate, you're to administer it for the family, consult with my oldest son about how it should be invested, how it should be administered. We were able to argue that that created a scenario and the alternative, if we didn't win the will contest, that in the alternative it created, if we didn't win the will contest, the will was upheld, it created a secret trust. And basically all that it creates a constructive trust which is allowed as a remedy when a testator conveys property to another with the understanding that it'll be held for a third person. And so we contended that he gave his entire estate to his wife to hold for the benefit of the entire family, including the 10 kids and all the grandkids, and it would have required her to set aside property in a constructive trust, or in this case a secret trust, for those children. We never got to that because the case settled, but because of the will and because of the way it was set up, we ended up reaching a settlement for our clients, who were 4 of the 10 children, which was 26% of the entire estate when they were entitled to far less than that under intestacy laws. And so it was a victory, but because of all of this, we were able to create enough problem and enough concern with the other side that they just needed to get rid of us and make sure that they preserved as much of the estate for them as possible. So it came out to be a good result, but it all really goes back to what happened with the will, what happened with the process and it being created, and the fact that the Scrivener attorney had no notes to refer to in relation to how it came about. So all of this that we're talking about, all of this I'm telling you about, is really boils down to the reason why we do this is to, you want to prepare to defend the will. If a will contest is filed, you want to have enough in your file to make sure that you can defend whatever it was that you prepared. And so you want to develop a good process. You want to develop a habit of keeping good notes, and I'll explain a few other things that can be done to help in this regard. But the main reason is you want to be able to testify and prepare to defend your work product. And as an estate planner, particularly an attorney estate planner, the scrivener of the will is the defender, sort of the police at the door defending that testator, the client, from undue influence or from being taken advantage of in a weakened mental state. And that creates a high burden on the Scrivener. That's flipping to page 12 or slide 12. I don't usually like to read quotes when I give speeches, but this one is so good that I think it deserves being read aloud so that the points can be heard and be made. In the Palmer versus Unauthorized Practice of Law Committee of the State Bar of Texas, this was written. There's no phase of the law which requires more profound learning than on the subject of trusts, powers, the law of taxation, legal and equitable estates, perpetuities, etc. These duties cannot be performed by an unlicensed person, not an attorney, and who is untrained in such complex legal subjects. And so that really underscores the importance of estate planning in the law practice, but also in the lives of the clients. And so when people take it upon themselves, and I'll show an example here in a minute, but when people take it upon themselves to start drafting wills for someone else and they're not a lawyer, oftentimes they're the one that would benefit from that process. It really becomes problematic for them and technically would be the unauthorized practice of law that would subject them to being prosecuted by the state bar. But that rarely happens, but the point is that all of this stuff, when you put it all together, encompasses so many different areas of law, so many different areas of property law, estate planning law, oil and gas law. It can be really corporate law. It can be really run the gamut of what a person might own. It requires someone who's trained in those areas to be able to deal with it. This doesn't seem like a very difficult or complex topic, but we've been surprised at how often attorneys will testify that they do not have fiduciary duties to their client. I believe, based upon the Palmer site and the obvious formal fiduciary relationship that an attorney and a client have, or financial planner and client, or accountant and client, that in this area of law, in this area where you're planning estates, and which is, we've seen is a complex legal matter, the scrivener absolutely has fiduciary duties and obligations. That gatekeeper or that defender of the client, that goes back to fiduciary duties. A lot of attorneys don't believe they have fiduciary duties. We're on page 13, slide 13. One of the things that I believe in a state planner, someone who's drafting a will and performing the will execution ceremony, needs to know is they need to have some basic idea about the scrivener, about the testator's testamentary capacity, their ability to enter into the business in which they're engaged, the will itself. And that goes into the falls into the category of having fiduciary duties. One of the statements in self-proving affidavits is that the formalities have been and solemnities have been followed, and part of that is that the testator be of sound mind. Well, if the scrivener attorney doesn't know whether the testator is of sound mind, I guarantee you that the witnesses don't know that and the notary doesn't know that unless they know the testator personally, and that rarely comes up. And so the scrivener attorney has, I believe, a duty of due diligence to test the test, to give tests, to ask questions, to find out if the testator has the testamentary capacity to sign a will. And that doesn't require necessarily a mental status exam, but it does require that some due diligence be done to determine, beyond just small talk, to determine what the testator understands about why they're in the office, about what the will says and what they're doing and what the will actually does. And so simple questions can be asked. Who's the president? Where are you? What day of the month is it? Where did you come from? Who drove here? Who did you talk to before today? If you really think there's a problem, you can start asking mental status questions that would test their memory, such as saying three objects and then 5 minutes later having the testator tell those objects back to you or say them again. You can ask them judgment type questions such as, people in glass houses should not do what, and see if they can logically answer that question, analyze it, and give you a logical should not throw stones type response. And so the scrivener has to do something to determine mental status. Now, if it's a 25-year-old or a 40-year-old or a younger person that there's just no question that they have high functioning, they're a practicing attorney or they're a doctor or they're working every day, they're running a business, whatever it may be, then that kind of stuff is not necessary and would probably be overkill. But when people deal with older clients that may be entering the early stages of Alzheimer's or may have some health infirmity that causes them to be weakened or even a mental problem, whether it doesn't have to necessarily be brain damage, but it could be dementia of any type, Alzheimer's dementia, these kinds of questions must be asked. And a person with Alzheimer's doesn't necessarily lack the capacity to sign a will. It depends on what stage of the Alzheimer's process that person is in. But if you don't ask the questions and then you don't put those types of responses and questions and responses in your notes, then again, a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, you'll never remember what you ask and what was said, what questions were responded to correctly or incorrectly. And it creates a real problem. And all the scrivener attorney can really do is testify, well, it was just small talk. Well, small talk is not good for a scrivener attorney or estate planner who has fiduciary duties to the client. So really emphasizes the point to make sure that testator has the basic level of testamentary capacity to follow through with the execution of the will. If the questions aren't asked and notes aren't taken that preserve that activity, the scrivener attorney or estate planner will never be able to vouch for the testamentary capacity of the client. And so when it comes up in a will contest and the question is asked, do you have an opinion about whether the testator had the capacity to sign this will at the time it was executed, they're probably going to say yes, because that's what they have to do to support the work product. But then the next question is, well, why do you think that? You don't have any notes. You can't remember the day. You don't know what you all talked about. You don't know any question that was asked. You don't know what he said to anyone else. And then, you know, that yes then becomes tainted or loses its effectiveness. It becomes weaker testimony. And, you know, that's the scrivener attorney or the scrivener estate planner is going to be the person that the jury is going to look to, because they're supposed to have been there at the time of execution. They're going to expect that person to be able to testify and give an opinion that's supported by something to support that will execution. And we see time and time again where that's not done. So back to the fiduciary relationship, and I get on slide 14, I'll give you an example of a deposition that I took of an attorney that absolutely first didn't really know what a fiduciary relationship was, which was shocking in and of itself, but did not consider her job as an estate planner for the testator decedent to be a fiduciary relationship. I asked her if she agreed that an attorney-client relationship is a fiduciary relationship. She said she would not necessarily define it that way. It's an attorney-client relationship, maybe some elements, but I don't know that I would specifically term it fiduciary in the same manner that I would like a power of attorney. Well, that's ridiculous, but in any event, that's what she said. Skipping down to line 16, I asked, do you believe the attorney-client relationship is a formal relationship? What do you mean by formal fiduciary relationship? She said, what do you mean by a fiduciary relationship? Do you know what a fiduciary relationship is? Well, she said, I understand how I would define it, but to answer your question, I need to know how you define it. Well, how do you define it? And she said, depends on the situation. So, shockingly, she didn't even know what a fiduciary obligation was, which means that she obviously could not have provided fiduciary obligations or provided fiduciary duties to her client. And in this case, this is just a fail. I mean, she had no idea what she was doing and shouldn't have ever undertaken to do that estate plan in the first place. So the next topic that comes up in will contests, lack of testamentary capacity is one cause of action. The other one that's used really equally as often is undue influence. And so on slide 15, again, attorneys all the time testify they don't have fiduciary duties, they don't have the obligation to make sure that that testator was not unduly influenced coming into the office or at the time of the execution, and therefore they don't take any steps to, in their process, they don't take any steps to avoid or prevent undue influence from happening. And this is a huge mistake. This, that we see this all the time. And it goes back to the Palmer side. What's the point of having an attorney or having a qualified estate planner to help in this process if they're not there to protect the person from somebody else's advances or somebody else, or the pressure of somebody else to sign a will they would not have otherwise signed? And so the scrivener of the estate plan really needs, along with the questions that I mentioned earlier, really needs to take notice of the situation, needs to find out how the testator got there. Did that person drive or not? Well, not driving there doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it could mean that they can't drive anymore. Well, that can be a red flag. Who called to make the appointment? Who called to provide the information that is being put in the will? Is someone there with them at the time the will is being executed? Are they out in the lobby? Are they down in the car? Are they sitting right next to them at the table? All of those things, all of those factors come into play when determining whether somebody is involved in the process that shouldn't obviously be involved. Usually it's a person that's becomes the beneficiary of the estate plan. And so that gives the scrivener of the estate plan the ability to, hopefully, gives the ability to analyze the, who is the strong person in the relationship of the parties that are there, who's the weak one, is the testator the one that's being pressured to take advantage of, meet with the client alone. I mean, I can't emphasize that enough. The first point is to meet with the client. I've had more than a handful of cases where the attorney never even once spoke with the client, that all the information that was conveyed was by some third party, an accountant or a wife or a son or daughter. Most recently, we had a case where the attorney was a friend of the husband, surviving spouse of the decedent, and every single communication that conveyed a message to that attorney about what she wanted in her will came through an email of her husband. There wasn't a record in the invoices that he ever spoke with his client. There wasn't a record that she ever sent him an email. And he admitted under oath that he never met her, never talked to her on the phone, and all the information in the will came from her husband, who was the 100%, ultimately the 100% beneficiary of her estate. So not only, it seems obvious to say, well, you need to meet with your client, but it doesn't happen as often as you think. And there's a published case that I was involved with where that became a factor in the appeal. The court made note that the attorney never once spoke to his client. But then also, if someone is there in the process and has injected themselves in the process and they're at the meeting and they make the call to set up the meeting and they're sitting there next to the testator, it's time to kick them out of the process. And so send that person out so you can have a conversation so the scrivener, estate planner can have a conversation with that client directly, alone, in a scenario where the client can, within the attorney-client privilege, can convey anything that he or she needs to convey to the attorney, which will allow that attorney to properly and directly protect that person from a bad actor or someone who's overreaching. These all fall into the fiduciary duties relating to representing a client in their estate plan. And if any scrivener believes that they don't have those fiduciary duties to protect their client, they're going to, first of all, I think that's ridiculous. That's a horrible approach. It's a failure in the process, and they'll end up having to pay the consequences of explaining why they didn't have to do these things. Oftentimes, they'll testify, all I did was just find out what he wanted and put it on a piece of paper to have him sign it. Well, that's to say that's the minimum is not even accurate. That would be, in my opinion, incompetent estate planning work. You got to do more than just regurgitate what you understand the client's desires to be. There's more to the process than just putting words on a paper and getting a signature. And I think I've emphasized that enough. Also, to extend that a little further, slide number 16, part of getting that information about the client, your client, is to explore the relationships. Find out what kind of relationship the testator has with their spouse or with their children or grandchildren or nieces or nephews, and determine if there's a close enough relationship to justify the treatment, or the opposite, if there's a rift or a schism in the relationship that prevents or that justifies a prevents a close relationship and justifies a disinheritance of that child or whoever is being disinherited. Were they estranged? Did they do something that was so bad that the testator could never forgive them for it? I'm one of those people that believes that a parent's love for their child and vice versa is unconditional. And so that's an approach I take in a lot of cases. Some people don't believe that, and that's something that has to be explored with a jury. But if that's the opening premise, then it becomes very difficult to justify a parent disinheriting a child. And it usually has to be something that's so bad they haven't talked to them in 30 years, they had a fight 30 years ago and never spoke again, or something as extreme as they murdered somebody, or there's something more than just we had an argument, or gave my son a loan and he never paid it back, or things that would normally be forgiven by a parent towards their child usually is not sufficient to justify a disinheritance. It can be, but as a will contestant lawyer, which I do most often, there has to be a reason for a disinheritance. A jury is looking for a good reason or some justification for a disinheritance. And sometimes we hear, oh, well, he or she gave gifts during their lifetime and they've given them enough. Well, that's a really horrible excuse for a disinheritance. Particularly if it's a child. And so find out and explore the relationships and determine whether the estate plan that's being put down on paper makes sense. Does it make sense that John Doe, that son over there that is being disinherited, is disinherited? If it doesn't make sense, a jury can't latch onto it as being a good reason why someone's disinherited. Well, that would be grounds. It would be a preponderance of the evidence, which is all that's required, that would support setting aside the probate of such a will. And so, all that being said, slide 17, you get to the point where you're preparing the will, and certainly, I mentioned regurgitating what the testator said. It's kind of a bad way to put it, but it's the most basic task is to get down on paper exactly what the testator wanted. What did they convey as being their intent and desire? And then did you accurately write it down and put it down so that it properly reflects their intent? We see a lot of cases where the scrivener of the estate plan does not accurately convey on the piece of paper what the testator wanted, and then later they have to eat a little crow when they admit that they've made a mistake and did not properly put down in the will exactly the testator's intent. And then what do? We seize upon that opportunity and say, well, if that doesn't reflect the testator's intent, the will is invalid because it doesn't reflect exactly what the testator wanted. Oftentimes they have to admit that. Well, that obviously would be a preponderance of the evidence and would get the will kicked. But the worst thing an estate planner can do is to inject themselves into the desires of the testator, to hear what the testator is saying and then determine themselves what the testator really wants. And that can have extreme detrimental effects, and it does happen on occasion. So you got to put down what they want correctly. Don't put down what you believe they want or what you infer based upon what you know they really want. You have to put it down correctly. And then, obviously, once it's put down in the will, you see on slide 7, proof, proof, proof. I can't emphasize enough the value and the obligation, I believe, of an estate planner to proof a will and make sure that there are no mistakes in it, that all the provisions work together correctly. It seems basic. It seems like it shouldn't have to be said, that you make sure that the will works the way it should. But you can have patent ambiguities in the will, such as one that we see a lot, a provision that refers to if so-and-so dies, then this passes according to the residuary clause stated below, and then you go down below and there's no residuary clause. And that happens all the time. And that's just the basic minimum required competence, which is to proof the document and make sure that the provisions say what the testator wants and that all of the provisions work together. And then, of course, along with meeting with the client in person and alone, you want to make sure and go over the will to determine that they understand it. It's very important not to just ask leading questions. You don't get anything relating to a testator's capacity if you ask leading questions and the answer to all of them is yes. Ask open-ended questions. What was it that you wanted to do with your in relation to your children? Let's look at this provision. Does that properly set out exactly what you want? Versus, you told me you wanted Johnny to get $50,000. Is that correct? Yes. And that's what it says right here, correct? Yes. Well, that doesn't tell you anything about the testator's capacity. So it's important to get into, as part of the process, to get into what the testator actually knows about the will. Slide 18, getting into the execution of the will, it's very important. You got to make sure it's a big deal. You don't want to let the process get so routine that you don't treat every will as like a new client, or every will execution by a client as a new client. It needs to be a big deal, even though you don't feel good, even though you may not want to have to deal with it, you're super busy and this is just time out of your day. You can't let that taint the execution or the process of the will, because if you do, then there most likely will be holes that we as litigators will be able to capitalize on. You want to make sure that the execution is done correctly, that the will execution ceremony, which sounds pretty formal, but really it is formal. You want to make sure all the things that are supposed to be said are actually said, that the testator signs first and the will witnesses actually witness the testator's signature. It's important to put that in your notes, too, because that's something that we capitalize on, because people usually can't remember 3 years later what order the documents were signed. It's also pretty important to have the scrivener participate in the process of the execution. Oftentimes, some lawyers will write the will, they'll give it to their notary and hand it to them and say, you go take care of this. And the notary goes in there and does whatever they're supposed to do. Oftentimes, they don't even know what they're supposed to do. And so I took deposition recently of a notary who notarized the will, and she couldn't even tell me the process and admitted that she didn't say anything other than just signing the jurat after after everybody signed. Well, of course, part of that, if you're signing a self-proving affidavit, she's got to administer an oath. And I can't tell you how many times we get people to admit that they were never given an oath, that they did not sign a self-proving affidavit under oath, and that they were not swearing to anything that day. Well, that destroys the effect of the self-proving affidavit. You don't, in Texas, you don't need a notary to sign a will. You need a notary to administer an oath and acknowledge signatures in the self-proving affidavit. And if they don't do that correctly, well, then what's the point of even doing it? The other thing I recommend on slide 19, and I won't go into this too much, but have annual reviews. I think that a lot of opportunity is missed by attorneys or estate planners who do an estate plan and then they never see their client again. You know, 10 years later, 15 years later, that person dies and you pull out their will and shake the dust off of it. And you haven't talked to them since and you don't remember what happened and your notes are weak and there's just not a whole lot there to support the document. One of the hardest things we deal with as estate and trust litigators, will contest litigators, is where there's a well-documented history of what the testator wanted. That attorney can go to their file and they can point to year after year after year, we had annual reviews, things change in people's lives, person dies, or a new grandbaby is born, or there's a fight within the family and now he or she's not talking to one of the children, or whatever, things change in person's life. Maybe it doesn't maybe you don't have to have a review annually. I recommend it, but at least every other year to make sure that the estate plan actually continues to be the testator's desires. If we have five or six different wills that say the same thing or express essentially the same estate plan, those are way more difficult to contest than a will that's done at the end of life that is a complete aberration from earlier wills or is alters intestacy or something of that nature. So having a long history and documenting that history, usually through annual reviews, which I recommend, is a real good practice. It's real important in the process if you're trying to defend an estate plan and you're trying to knowing exactly what the testator wanted and you're trying to convey that you're very familiar with your client and very familiar with what they wanted, having that history is important. Slide 20, this is really a Texas slide, but it's really here to make the point that there are methods of changing probates of wills or orders that are made by the court in Texas, depending on what stage of the probate process you're in. If you catch some error or there's a mistake in the process within 30 days after the order, you can file a motion for new trial. If you find substantial error on the record in Texas, you can ask the court for a statutory bill of review up to 2 years after the date of the order. Supreme Court recently eliminated equitable bills of review and probate because it held that the statute establishing a probate bill of review trumps the equitable bill of review. The will contest statute is the one we use most often, and it's basically a bill of review, but it's for different grounds. It's substantive, lack of capacity, or undue influence grounds. The bill of review is a technical challenge on how a probate was actually done. The will contest actually challenges the document itself. That can be done up to 2 years after the order. And then a restricted appeal, which is very rare, but it basically requires that the error appear on the face of the record and that the party appealing did not have notice of it and was not present and did not participate in the hearing. Those don't happen very often. The will contest is the one that happens most often. Slide 21, these are the usual grounds for a will contest: lack of testamentary capacity, undue influence, fraud and forgery. I bring those up just to show you that those are the causes of action we usually file. Slide 22 is the bill of review, which I just mentioned and won't go into further. I can certainly ask questions or answer questions about that afterwards. But it comes into play often a lot in relation to the execution that I was talking about earlier. If the execution is done improperly, if an oath wasn't given, if the will witness is signed out of order, if there's something that can nullify the self-proving affidavit or the probate process itself, well, that's something that can be attacked as substantial error, and the probate order can be modified or even set aside. So, slide 23 makes, just to make the point that mistakes in the execution of the will can lead to the set aside of a self-proven will. Slide 24 is a perfect example of it. This is an actual self-proving affidavit. This was a will that was bought off the internet that they took to a UPS store, and these two will witnesses, Stephen Bowen and Paul Lane, I believe is his name, were either working at the UPS store or they were standing there and agreed to witness the execution of the will. So it's real important to show you the point. It's real important to notice the signature of Paul Lane on line 2, and I'll show you why in just a minute. If slide 25, the self-proving affidavit must be made by the testator and by the attesting witnesses. So in order to have a self-proving affidavit in this particular will, Stephen Bowen and Paul Lane had to sign as witnesses to the affidavit itself, verifying that everything was done correctly. This would also apply if the oath wasn't given, anything that would invalidate that self-proving affidavit, which would in turn, would invalidate the probate. Flipping over to slide 26, this is the previous signature page was the attestation clause where Bowen and Lane signed it. This is the self-proving affidavit on slide 26. You can see Stephen Bowen signed as a witness, but then they got some other person to sign as a witness to the self-proving affidavit, and then there's that signature again. Paul Lane became the notary. And so this, on its face, invalidated the self-proving affidavit. And because it was proven up as a self-proven will, and the added or extra proof that was required to probate a will that's not self-proven was not provided, the entire probate itself was invalid, and the probate order was set aside, and they basically had to start over because it's a mandatory, in Texas it's mandatory, it's jurisdictional, that everything be done correctly. And so because the prove up was incorrect, the prove up being a self-proving self-proven will prove up, it lacked all the necessary proof once this was determined to be invalid to probate a will that's not self-proven, and the will was set aside, and it became a pre-probate contest a year and a half after it had been probated. A couple other examples on page or slide 27. The will was probated as a self-proven will in a case we had, and on bill of review, I was able to prove that the attestation clause was forged, which means that the signatures on the self-proving affidavit stepped forward or were moved up to become the signatures to the will, but it lost its self-proving effect. As a result, because it was proven up as a self-proven will, the order probating the will was set aside because the process of getting it probated was done incorrectly. Again, the added proof that's necessary to probate the will as a not self-proven will or non-self-proven will was not provided. That was 2 years after the probate, and it was set aside and became a pre-probate contest. Both those cases ended up settling after that bill of review was granted. Another one that came up is there's a procedure for proving up a will on written questions, and in Texas you have to get a commission and post notice for 10 days and let anybody that wants to ask questions ask those questions. They didn't follow the procedure to the letter of the law, therefore the prove up was improper, and the based on a bill of review, substantial error on the record, and or substantial error in the process, and the wills were set aside. So not only, you can see how a failure in the execution then, because it appears to be regular on its face, causes a failure in the probate process and creates all kinds of issues that do not need to exist. So over to slide 28, mistakes in the will. This comes up more times than I can tell you. In almost every case, there's some sort of a mistake in the will itself. And so follow along with this because I want to guide you through this, but you can see how horribly detrimental it can be for a scrivener. In this case, it was an attorney, for a scrivener to make a mistake in himself in transposing onto a page what the testator wanted in their will. And so on slide 29, this was deposition testimony that's very important in this, in understanding what happened here. I was asking this attorney at line 8, I want to ask you that the $100,000 to Sonia in paragraph B1 and that in paragraph B2, 12.5% to David and Nathan and then everything else to Luana. And he says, that's what she told me very clearly. That's the testator. The testator told him that very clearly. And I say, that's what she told you very clearly? Yeah. And you didn't suggest any of the percentages or any of that? No. Who did? She, the testator, suggested that. She suggested, and my question was, she suggested that I want 12.5% to David and 12.5% to Nathan. And he says, yes. And then look what happens, slide 30. Slide 30, the paragraph that leaves the 12.5% to Nathan and the 12.5% to David actually says, 12.5% of the trust estate shall be distributed to the children of Luana Zellner, which is David and Nathan, in equal shares. Well, that conveys to each of them 6.25%, not the 12.5% that he previously testified that she, the testator, directly told him she wanted. So then I test him some more and ask him, and the second distribution is 12.5% of the trust to the children of Luana in equal shares. And he says, yes. In relation to the second distribution, this is on line 21 of slide 31, in relation to the second distribution, the language that's used, once again, calls for the 12.5% to be divided among David and Nathan, doesn't it? And he says that's correct. Slide 32, such that each of them would get a 6.25%. Correct. Well, that's contrary to what Donna, according to you, Donna had told you she wanted, isn't it? And he says, no, that's exactly what she wanted. And I tell him, earlier you testified that she wanted David and Nathan to get 12.5% each. And we refer to Exhibit 3, and he says that that indicates to Sonia that Donna's intent is that David get 12.5% and Nathan get 12.5%. And he says, I made a mistake. I made a mistake on that. That's really not correct. So I ask if the mistake was in the Exhibit 3, the memo, or if it was in the document itself that he wrote. And he says it's in the memo at line 21. And so you're now saying that Donna's intent that David and Nathan each receive 6.25%. That's correct. That's what I stated here. And that's what's stated in the trust. And then I ask him, so your testimony earlier that Donna wanted 12.5% to David and Nathan is not correct. And he says, what's stated in the memorandum is not correct and that he made a mistake. And and then going down to the next slide, page 34, I ask him about the percentage. She wanted it to be divided, the 12.5% to be divided between the two of them. And what did she say to you in that regard? I can't remember. You don't have any notes that reflect that that's what she wanted, do you? And he said no. So this was a disaster for them. We first read a memo where he writes down that she wanted 12.5% to go to each of David and Nathan, which I believe was clearly what she had indicated to him in their discussions what he wanted. Then he wrote down that it be split equally, And that probably, in my opinion, was a mistake. And in order to cover up his actual mistake, he said the memo was wrong, not his incorrect transposition of what she wanted into the document was wrong. And so this was a disaster. If the attorney that wrote the will for the testator could not himself understand what it did, then there was no way that the testator herself could understand what it did. And this case basically ended after the deposition of this scrivener attorney. And so mistakes are come up all the time, and they're horribly detrimental to attempting to show that the will is valid. And the reason it goes back to the intent question. If the will is supposed to outline the intent of the testator and accurately reflect the intent of the testator, and then turn around and it does not accurately reflect the intent of the testator, well, then the will is basically worthless and should be tossed out. Some people argue, well, it's just that one provision where there was a mistake. We argue absolutely the opposite. The whole document's supposed to reflect what she wanted, not just everything but one provision. But here's the thing with that. The reason that becomes important is because, and we say this all the time and ask people all the time, a will is supposed to be the most important document that a person signs in their lifetime. And if they're competent, if any of us on this in this conference sat down and read our will, we would be able to read that it doesn't reflect it. It says 6.5% to each instead of 12.5% to each. Those kinds of things. And if that person was competent, if that person could sit down and read this will and know what it said and know how it worked and assess whether it reflected their intent, well, then if they're competent, they would be able to call it out, tell the scrivener that they want to make changes to get it to so that it works right, and it would be fixed. You get to the point that that person is dead, and now we're looking at their will, and does it accurately reflect their intent? Well, that is direct evidence, in my opinion, and we use it all the time, and we argue it all the time, that's direct evidence that that person lacked testamentary capacity because they didn't catch that mistake. And in that case, the attorney didn't even catch it until the deposition. And so, slide 35, another big problem that we see a lot and that no one wants to have as part of their estate planning process is, as I mentioned earlier, injecting yourself into the client's testament or the client's will. But the first job is to write down what they want accurately so it reflects their intent. Not to interpret what they told you and infer what they might want, but to accurately reflect it. But in this case, in the case I'm going to show you, the scrivener attorney was the daughter of the decedent's girlfriend, and she became the scrivener of his will. And she wrote a will for him that was contested, and then later, realizing that he had a taxable estate, was going to refer him, or did refer him, to an attorney to do a tax estate plan, because that was over her head. Well, in the process of making the referral and conveying to that new lawyer what the testator, which was her client, what he wanted, she wrote, this is slide 37, she wrote an email. I'm sorry, hold on. This is, slide 37. She wrote an email. And so the thing to notice on this email, the substance is not all that important, but the thing to notice here is that it says, is the last two paragraphs of the email on slide 37. You can notice here that it says a couple of things to point out on the form. Mac has 7 children, etc. And then the next paragraph, it says, I am away from my office today, but will forward a copy of the executed will to you via email. Well, in her business record affidavit forwarding her file, she swore that all the documents she prepared were true and correct copies of the documents that she kept in the normal course of her business. She then, under oath, confirmed that was the case, and that the documents she produced were true and correct copies kept in the normal course of her business. And then she specifically confirmed that this particular email, March 20th, 2013, was a true and correct copy of the email actually sent to the attorney that she referred her client to. Well, as with any email, if it gets sent, there's a sender and then there's a recipient. And so we subpoenaed the file of the new lawyer that she referred them to, and on slide 38, you see again, now there's three paragraphs at the end. The first one is that one that says a couple of things to point out on the form. Mac has seven children, and then it says everything else verbatim. And then there's another paragraph, and then it says, I'm away from my office today, but I will forward a copy of the executed will via email tomorrow. And then you see that middle paragraph was not in her form. And what does it say? Finally, confidentially and bluntly speaking, Mac included in his will a relatively modest specific bequest of $100,000 for Annette. I'm not advocating that anyone pressure Mac to direct more to her, but I'm pointing out that if it was advantageous to Mac to gift or leave more to Annette for tax or whatever reason, it would be very much appreciated. That being said, I will not press the issue again. So she had manipulated her file. She had deleted this from her email. She didn't want anyone to see it. She testified that she made a mistake. She testified that she lied under oath, committed perjury, and the excuse for it all was that she was embarrassed by it and wished she hadn't sent it. Well, the big problem here, setting aside the perjury and the exposure of her law license for a minute, the big problem here is that she injected herself into the process to benefit her mother, which was her family, and had no business whatsoever doing it. And so, of course, she was embarrassed. She was committing an unethical act, which she then made worse by committing another unethical act by deleting that paragraph from the exhibit, and then made it even worse by committing perjury on three different occasions. So this was a disaster for her in trying to testify about the process. It really destroyed all of her credibility if she's going to commit perjury and lie about this particular email that she sent, then she's going to lie about everything. And so her testimony was completely shot, and this case ended up settling not too long after that. So the moral of that story is certainly don't inject yourself into your client's thought processes and infer that your client wants a certain thing by what they may be telling you. It's important to accurately reflect what they tell you rather than inferring more than what it is they told you. But then obviously, and this clearly would go without saying it for anyone acting ethically, don't doctor evidence, don't manipulate evidence, and don't lie about it once you're busted. Once you're caught in the act. All right, moving over to another horrible example of or example of a horrible process on slide 39. This is one where an attorney, going back to that Palmer quote, in this case it was a non-lawyer who was helping her husband supposedly prepare a will. And no attorney or advisor or anyone was involved with this. You can see that this particular will was a store-bought will. It looks a little bit irregular, and I'll tell you that it was a store-bought will, so to speak, bought off the internet. And I think there's a few slides missing, which I've updated and will be on the other slideshow that should be updated permanently, but what I'll tell you is the bottom of this page, 1 of 4 on slide 39, was those starting section 6 executors and then two sentences there, that was the top of the second page of this will. And so what clearly happened in this was that something was taken off of the first page that moved the top of the second page up onto the first page, so that the same language was on the second page as well, and we were able to obviously prove that after this document was signed that something was removed from the first page, which happened to be the page where the dispositive provisions are contained. after this, on the third page, there was a huge long area that was blank, and then on the signature page, it showed that the will had been signed on May 23rd of 2009. The wife of the decedent testified that she was there. It was signed on May 23rd, 2009. The witness, one of the witnesses to the will was the wife's sister, and the other was her boyfriend. They both testified that the will was signed on May 23rd, 2009. And we then asked her, well, where did you get this form? And she said, I got it off of willing.com, W-I-L-L-I-N-G.com. Well, this was a porn site in its former life, back in the early 2000s, but it was, the domain was purchased and it went live for the first time ever in June of 2015. And we called the owner of willing.com and talked to him directly, and he said that the form that was there that she purchased was not in existence prior to June of 2015. And so this was a total fraud. It was one that we ended up being able to show was executed or signed, I should say, after the date of the testator's death. And it was a total fraud, and the timing of it, May 23rd, 2009 was the date of the will. The form didn't go live until June of 2015. I mean, this was not only a fraud, it would be something that would have been or could have been prosecuted by a district attorney, but it ended up not being prosecuted because she basically backed off. She settled the case, and as part of that, everybody agreed to just keep it amongst us in relation to whether to report it to the DA. So, this was egregious, and this is the problem with not having an advisor who's experienced in estate planning and how bad things can get when someone is, in this case, was desperate to make sure that they inherited the entire estate. So, flipping over to slide number 44. Slide number 40. It says logic must prevail, and this is the one of my final points. The thing that has to happen, and the things that has to be the overriding construct for all of this is that you have to make sure that the process works logically from start to finish, that there was a basis for creating the attorney-client relationship that was sound, that the discussions regarding what someone wanted, what the client wanted was sound, and then that the process of getting the will created was done correctly and works correctly, and then the execution was done properly. And if there's any break in that process, it just exposes the entire thing to being attacked by will contest lawyers. But most importantly, going back to, you have to make sure the will works correctly. There has to be, logic must prevail. The will has to be logical. If it's not, then again, it argues that somebody else was involved in the process, or that the testator was not able to catch errors or mistakes that happened in the will. One of the things we see all the time, I wouldn't say every case, but in a whole lot of cases where someone is disinherited, is the will says, I leave my estate to Jane Doe, for instance, and then there's no other alternate beneficiary named, and then the next paragraph says, if Jane Doe does not survive me, I leave my estate to my heirs at law. And the people that have been cut out of the will are the heirs at law. And so what happens is, in a deposition or in trial, we attack that document and say, look, the testator did not want these kids to inherit anything under any circumstances. Is that correct? Yes. Or maybe it's a particular person. Did not want that person to inherit anything under any circumstance. Is that correct? That's correct. Under no circumstances did the testator want his or her son or his or her children to get anything from his or her estate. Well, then why does the will provide that if Jane Doe, the wife, passes away before him, that those very people that he did not want to take from his estate inherit the entire estate? That's the problem with wills that are not logical. If there's a mistake, if there's an error in logic, if there's some reason why the will does not work correctly, then it opens the door to us arguing that the testator, if he or she was confident, could have and would have caught it, and in this case did not catch it. And so that's where I was going to show you some of the videos. These videos are very interesting in that they are direct evidence. Usually undue influence is proven by circumstantial evidence, but these videos, I think you'll enjoy watching them. They're not very long, usually less than a minute, show you exactly what undue influence looks like and how it occurs. One of them, the second video, is really just a recording that was on a video camera. And so all you can do is hear the wife coaxing her very elderly husband into disinheriting his children. So the first one, the elderly testator starts going off script and saying that she wanted something that they did not count on, and so they want to cut the tape off, which was great. And then the second one is a video with the audio of the undue influencing or convincing the elderly testator to cut his children out. And then the last one, it just kind of speaks for itself, where the lady, who usually goes to bed at 6:30 or 7, was there at 9:03 p.m., this is slide 44, being told what was in her will and what she was going to sign, and her being so tired that she could not resist and ended up signing the will right there on video at the direction of the bad actor. So those are very, very interesting. Try and take a look at them if you have a few minutes. I think you'll enjoy them. And then, in conclusion, all of the things that I've spoken about are things that we use in seeking to set aside wills and seeking to attack the validity of wills and trusts also. And it goes to examining the entire process of the will coming into being and how it was and the execution of it in that process. But in addition to that, in order to help with those arguments, the evidence that we would use to corroborate those arguments that we're making about the person lacking capacity because they couldn't catch mistakes or it doesn't reflect their intent, we get medical records, and the medical records 9 out of 10 times make our case. They show that person was infirm, did have a condition that caused them to be weak and susceptible to undue influence, or did have a mental condition that prevented them from being able to understand who their children were, or who the natural objects of their bounty were, or what property they owned, or the business in which they were engaged, and being able to formulate a reasonable judgment about them at the time, and then sign the will. With all that, holding all that in their mind at the same time. So medical records are crucial. Medical experts are used to interpret the medical records and to render opinions after the fact based upon the medical records that this person usually could not understand the effect of making the will, the content of the will, and the business in which they were engaged. And oftentimes you'll find many mental status exams in medical records. And once you see those, if any of you have, you'll be able to see what they do. They run through a litany of tests and they give them a score, and based upon that score, the medical experts are able to assess whether that person could understand things, had sufficient memory, and could exercise reasonable judgment. So you take all that together, the mistakes in the will, whether the will's logical, the relationships, is someone getting disinherited, does that make sense? Is somebody involved in the process? Did the lawyer correctly put down everything that the testator wanted in the document itself? Did the lawyer inject themselves into the process so bad and to the extent that the will actually does not reflect their testamentary intent? Then you add medical records on top of that and medical expert testimony on top of that, and then you call lay witnesses that knew the decedent, usually someone that knew him for a long period of time, and they're able to compare the testator before to what the testator was at the time of the execution, and to opine that they were completely different people or they were not as sharp as they had been before. I don't believe that that testator was able to read that document or read it and understand it. You pile all that, you start piling all of that stuff on top of each other, one thing after another, and you remember preponderance of the evidence is just slightly more. The jury or the prior fact believes just slightly more, believes one side just slightly more than the other. When you start piling all that evidence onto your side of the equation, if these things that I'm telling you should be in your process are not done correctly, or there's a hole in the process, or it's so routine that it becomes mundane and things are not done correctly or habits are not followed, it just opens the door to all kinds of arguments. We get all kinds of mileage out of flaws in the process. And so the lesson clearly is to establish a process that you use all the time. A lot of times a good scrivener witness will say, that's our habit. We do it every time. 100% of the time, there's no doubt in my mind that we did it that way on that date because we don't deviate from our process. We do not deviate from our record. And I told you earlier, having a long history of what the testator wanted, a long established history of a consistent estate plan is extremely hard to defeat. The other piece of evidence that's very difficult for us to contend with is a really good scrivener estate planner that has a good reputation, a reputation for honesty, a reputation for ethical behavior, and that keeps good notes. If you can package all of that up, you have that type of a scrivener who has that type of a process that's that good and that buttoned up and is known to have a good reputation and is known to act ethically, has good notes, and then the document, normally, if all that happens, the document will accurately reflect the testator. But if done correctly and there is an annual review or an annual checkup or at least a long history of consistent testamentary plans, then it makes things very difficult, much more difficult for us as contestants to contest those documents. And if you're trying to defend your work product, then the best way to do that is to put all those processes in place so that your product is buttoned up, it's tight, and nobody can challenge it, because you have all of that support for it. The wills that are easiest for us to contest are the ones where that process doesn't exist, or it's flawed, or it wasn't followed, or something to that effect, and we're able to, usually it leaves the door open for a bad actor to take advantage. Certainly that client is not being defended by anyone, and either due to lack of capacity or undue influence, a will is signed that they would not have otherwise signed, and that's what we capitalize on as litigators. And so my time's about up, about 2 minutes left, which I'll give back, but I want to say thank you for your time and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present this and to show you some of the things that we see and to some degree tell you a few war stories. I think it's interesting. It certainly interests me, but I think seeing examples really underscores the reasons why I emphasize the process being so important and to get that established. As Rosemary said, my contact information is on my outline. I'm happy and available and will make time available anytime to answer any questions you have or address any issues you have regarding this or really anything relating to estate planning or estate administration or courtroom work relating to estates and trusts. So please don't hesitate to shoot me an email, give me a call, or whatever, and I'll make time to help you out any way I can. Thank you again for your time, and let me know if you have any other questions. That'll wrap up. Concludes my presentation.
All right. Thank you so much, Kevin. Those stories were definitely very interesting. Please keep in mind our next program will be April 26th for another estate planning topic for advisors, Estate Planning for Digital Death, What Happens When You've Logged Off for the Final Time, presented by Alice Haffeltine of Kirkland Woods and Martinson. Please make sure to RSVP as our program is increasing in popularity and we're filling our spaces quickly. We can send out email invitations, and if you're not on the distribution list, please see your location host and we'll make sure to include you. Thank you and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.